This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanksgiving this week is on a collision course with the coronavirus.
I don't think it's any surprise or any secret to anyone who's been turning on the TV, reading the papers, listening to the radio, or paying attention to any of the commentary, observations, and news about COVID and Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving clearly represents a big potential risk for the spread of COVID-19.
That's Governor Charlie Baker today at a press conference. With social media full of pictures of packed airports, public health officials in Massachusetts briefed mayors on what could quickly turn into a dire situation over the holidays. Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone was at that briefing yesterday and joins us now today. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Mayor Curtatone.
Thanks, Tiziana. It's great to be on the show again.
It feels like Thanksgiving is on everyone's minds, including public health officials. How are you going to spend it, Mayor Curtatone?
Well, for the first time in 28 years, I will be having Thanksgiving in a place other than with my wife's family. So from the time I met my wife in 1992, we've had a very large Thanksgiving gathering with her and extended family all the way. And this will be the first time. It'll just be my wife and I and our kids at our house. That's it.
Does that feel sad?
It is. It's somber. You know, those relationships, those personal relationships, those times to bond and share stories and be in very, you know, those familial and personal settings with the people you love are medicinal for all of us, that we need it. And we certainly need it in times like this when, you know, in addition to the loss of life and our lives and convenience being turned upside down and the harm to our economy, so many people going through so much an emotional and mental duress because of the stress and isolation of the situation.
You know, I've been wondering, A, are you hearing from constituents about Thanksgiving? And B, is it, you know, people mostly worried that others will get together, or is it people mostly upset that they have to be apart?
I think it's mostly worried about, overwhelmingly worried that people will get together. And really, what we need from everyone, from all of us, is to embody and act in a way that embodies our selfless spirit as Americans. And it's not about even us becoming ill. It's about making sure no one else becomes seriously ill or dies. And we know the data is pointing that it's in these familial and communal settings where the virus is spreading. And there's this heightened fear from very people far and wide, and not just from health experts, that the weeks following Thanksgiving and the holiday season can be very treacherous and dark.
You know, it really struck me just now when you said you're asking people to, quote, embody our selfless spirit as Americans. You know, I was thinking in getting ready for you today, if you find it easier or harder to get people to take the spread and the risks seriously now with what we know now than it was in the spring when so much was unknown.
I think there was a greater... It's tough to say, to be honest with you, because we've been fighting against so many things, the unknown, but the lack of leadership not just the lack and failure of leadership from our president at the national level, but a message that directly contradicts logic, science, and common sense. And we've been having, you know, our leaders should be at the front saying, follow me, do what I am doing on behalf of our fellow Americans, our neighbors, our loved ones, those frontline workers, those essential workers, those healthcare workers. And that's not happening. So it's been sort of this compounding challenge since the months of the very beginning months and times of this crisis all the way through now. The new challenge, I would say, is this promise of a vaccine, which is promising when you think of the efficacy of the vaccines that are being developed. But people need to understand that this virus is going to be with us for a long time. There's still no knowledge and no understanding whether or not we can still transmit the virus to others, even if we're vaccinated. And it's going to take months and months, maybe a year, to get the population fully vaccinated, because we still need to drive transmission down. And what we're seeing is a transmission level that's rising, perhaps to eclipse what we saw at the beginning, and that is really frightening. So, yeah, that makes our job, I think, challenging in a different way now. And so people are letting their guard down. And I think some of the actions the Commonwealth took to increase, allow gathering sizes to increase in the beginning of September and so forth, to go to the higher levels of phase three when our health experts were warning not to do that, especially since we're entering the cold and flu season. It makes it difficult for people to, when they look at that, to say, well, you allowed for a capacity in these other establishments to open. Why shouldn't I be able to have dinner with my family and friends in my home? So it's a,
yeah, let's
I think
talk
it
about
compounds
that.
A challenge. Yep.
So after a briefing, the briefing that we talked about for mayors, you told the Boston Globe that new measures may be might be needed to take control of the spread. What would those new measures be, and what would be your trigger for enacting them?
So, valid question. Let me just first clarify. The meeting wasn't with state health public experts, because from the very beginning, what you've seen is at the local and regional level, officials from cities and towns, large and small, stepping up to, one, close schools and issue stay-at-home advisories when the governor and the state was reticent against doing any of that. At the very beginning of the pandemic, that saved lives. And in the months that followed, the several months that have passed, we have been begging for a collaborative, coordinated approach, not just an individual city and town approach. We have 351 different approaches in Massachusetts to take it on the pandemic and now the resurgence, but one that is at least at a regional level, and to have common thresholds and measurements to understand when we should move ahead with a phase or roll back. And that is really the context of our conversation and in the present resurgence that we had yesterday with experts from the medical and health field. So we had two different panels. We had a medical expert panel that were mostly infectious disease doctors and those who are experts in contact tracing, and we had a panel of epidemiologists. So there is not one trigger. We asked the very same question, because these are the questions we asked the Commonwealth and the governor. What is the data you're looking at, and what will tell you to advise us to do X, to roll back a certain activity, or understanding we would allow something to expand? We never have gotten that to this date. And so what we're considering asking ourselves as municipalities, not just individually, but as regions across the Commonwealth, what are the common steps we should take now to take on, to knock down this resurgence? And we're trying to understand that. And we're policymakers. So the experts and their opinions and information and data, as well as modeling, inform that policy and decision-making. We have not come to a point to understand what that is. But there is some clear consensus here. One, hospitalization rates are rising at a rate that is, quote-unquote, from one of the experts, a worrisome sign. You know, it's looking bad. The fact that one expert said, the fact that we see the trends in hospitalizations rising at such a high rate before Thanksgiving is troublesome. We're also concerned that here in the Commonwealth, contact tracing has not lived up to its expectations. So that people know and understand, I want to clarify, we don't have a vaccine yet, and it's great we'll get one, but we have certain tools. Wearing a face covering, maintaining social distance, washing hands, contact tracing has to be one of those tools.
And why do you think it has not lived up to its potential?
Well, we brought this complaint to the governor, the administration, to their COVID task force. There are many reasons, factors why it's gotten better from where it was. But let me give you an example of how it's failing. Only 66% of the cases are being reached in the first day. So let me repeat that. More than a third of the people who need to be reached immediately, if they've come into direct contact with someone who's been tested positive for COVID, are not being reached, and time matters. Time matters because those people can become super spreaders themselves. And only 75% of the contacts are being reached, so more than 25% are not being reached at all. And that is not going to do, because contact tracing allows us, gives us information real time on what's happening with the pandemic and to act in real time to contain it. So when you ask me what we need to do, well, one, we need to get these things that we have control of, contact tracing, other measures, more testing and so forth, up to a level to give us the tools to prepare to respond to the pandemic. Then we need to ask ourselves, okay, what is the data showing us? Is it because of indoor dining that we see greater cases coming from? If that's the case, all right, well, the governor has said he's going to leave it up to individual municipalities now to make a decision on what should happen.
So
that's not going to work.
What will
we
you
need
do?
To work as a region.
So what will the region do? We're running out of time, and this restaurant question, I think, is actually really important because, as you know, there's a lot of tension about restaurants.
Yeah, people ask, are we going to roll everything back and shut everything down? Well, the difference here in the United States, in this state, one, in the United States, we don't have a national plan like other countries have. And two, other countries that have gone to total shutdown and rollbacks have also given those sectors greatly affected, like restaurants, like other industries, the resources, the money, the necessary to survive to get to the other side of this thing. And if the federal government's not going to step up right now, we can't expect them to happen anytime soon, then what is Massachusetts going to do? So we're going to ask the governor, will the Commonwealth be able to step in and give those businesses that we might have to roll back operations from the resources needed to survive this next phase, this resurgence? We don't have those answers yet. And those questions are really important. But one thing is for sure, it can't be one or two municipalities or several municipalities doing it. It will not have the impact against the resurgence we need. It has to be in a broader scale. And so whether it's indoor dining or other activities, we need to act collectively, collaboratively, and in sync with one another.
And that is Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone. I look forward to talking to you again soon, I hope, on this regional collaboration. I hope you'll come back.
I will, and everyone stay safe, please. Stay safe and be smart and have a happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, and happy Thanksgiving to you, too. All right, let's talk more about Thanksgiving. We just heard a lot from Somerville Mayor Joe Curtatone about what it's going to take to stay safe, what the pressures around Thanksgiving are, the decisions that remain to be made. This sits on us personally, too. I was looking at the weather this morning and thinking, I wonder if the weather is reflecting our collective mood on Thanksgiving right now. Are you sad? Are you worried about this week? Are you feeling restricted, agonizing about whether to be with loved ones despite public health guidance not to, or maybe having trouble thinking about how to have the conversation with loved ones because you're not going to do it? Or maybe you're finding joy and inspiration in your adaptations. I'd sure like to hear that. So join us, and we've got some guests to help us both commiserate, problem solve, celebrate. Call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can tweet us at Radio Boston. Now, we have two guests. With us are Meredith Goldstein, who runs the Boston Globe's Love Letters advice column and podcast, and Omar Ruiz, who is a licensed family therapist at Talk, Think, Thrive, a team of Newton Wellesley therapists. Welcome back to both of you, Meredith. Omar, great to have you back.
Hi.
Thank you so much.
And again, listeners, join this conversation. This is with you, 800-423-8255. So Meredith and Omar, I'm laughing because it seems like it was a lifetime ago, but we talked together at this time last year, and we were struggling with how to have difficult political conversations. We had no idea then what was coming now. Does this year feel much harder to you, Meredith?
Well, you know, what's interesting is now you can avoid those political conversations altogether. There are many good reasons to stay home. So that's the first. I mean, this is such a different year. It is mind-boggling to think about how different it is from last year. But now it is about feeling okay with not going and redefining what it means to care for loved ones. And, you know, I'm about to run a letter tomorrow in our Love Letters column from someone who is fighting with a spouse about letting the spouse's parents into their home for Thanksgiving. So it's also about negotiating with loved ones about who's allowed in and who should stay out. And, you know, thinking about what we were dealing with last year, it was important, but this is a whole new set of rules and problems.
Omar, are you hearing this? Obviously, without violating confidentiality, I don't mean to be disrespectful of your clients, but are you hearing in general from families that you talk to that this is a real source of difficulty and tension this year?
Definitely. In comparison to our conversation last year, things have completely shifted from not even thinking or wanting to discuss the recent election to just how do you coordinate to connect with families and friends just in this holiday season without the concern of contracting the virus.
And are you finding, Omar, that most people are going to make the decision not to be with loved ones outside their immediate household?
Yes. There are some couples who I've recently worked with in which you have the complete polar opposite sides. One in which they are completely fine with doing a Zoom Thanksgiving, while the other ones are saying, well, we've been socially isolated for so long that they have this need and desire just to be physically close to family members.
And Meredith, what about that social isolation and the letters and that you get and you know, the feedback that you get from readers? Are people feeling really lonely?
They are. And it doesn't have to be that they themselves are alone in a house. It could be that they live with a spouse or even children, but they are so longing for the people in their greater community. And I think it's forced a lot of people to, I think it's actually taken this long in some cases for, you know, they feel deserving. Well, I've done it right for this many months, but now I want to break the rules for this holiday. And, you know, what I tell people is, like, I have also seen great creativity in terms of how people connect. And that's what boosts me as a single person who lives alone. Like, I have a friend who sends me postcards. She lives in Cambridge. Like, she doesn't live far away from me. So This idea that my mail is more exciting than it's ever been, and there are these messages of love that actually feel very different and very fun. And certainly a lot of us have access to technology that we didn't even know how to use before. So it's learning how to feel good about that and to feel like that's enough. But I think for a lot of people, especially people who just want to give their grandkids a hug and people who live far away a hug, it's so difficult. And I heard a story this morning about a full airport and people just eating in the food court. And I thought, this isn't the answer. This isn't it.
So we are talking about Thanksgiving, adapting to this Thanksgiving in the age of coronavirus with Meredith Goldstein of the Boston Globe and Omar Ruiz, who is a licensed family therapist. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to the phones. We've got Charles on the line from Chelmsford. Charles, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Tiziana. Thanks so much for taking the call. I just wanted to call in and say I actually think it's a little bit of a relief. We're not planning on traveling anywhere. My family of four is just staying at home, and we're actually going to start a new little tradition in our house with my little kids. And even though my loved ones are actually in a town right nearby within just a few minutes' drive, we decided that we're going to stay put. And to me, it takes a lot of the pressure and off of me determining, you know, if I should go, if I should not, how am I going to get there? So I just wanted to add my comment that I'm trying to look at it as a positive and do something new and different for it without having to feel pressured into traveling when I ought to be staying home.
Charles, thanks for bringing that note of positivity. And Omar, I'll turn to you. You know, we do hear, especially families where there's maybe some distance and you've got two different families to go to, we hear about the stress of shuttling and balancing family demands. Is there a reprieve of sorts in being able to stay home? And also, what's the flip side of that if staying home means staying home completely alone?
Well, what I would say is for some, there are going to be that notion. There's going to be that notion where the knowing that you can't, or you're told to limit your travels based on the CDC recommendation, that in of itself is a great excuse to use to not visit family members. Because we also have to remember that just because it's the holiday season, not everybody has the greatest relationship of all times with their close family members or distant family members. So this is almost for some of relief. While others, because of the effects of the social isolation, they are looking for ways of how to convince their partners and their other family members to still continue their traditions. And we're now faced with how to, last year's conversation was how to navigate just the difficulty of political differences. Now we're navigating the difficulty of people's perception of a health crisis. And so either way, it's going to be a debate. And I would say for those who are needing a reprieve, this is the perfect reason for it. And it's not necessarily using facts, but more so speaking to the safety and concern of family members. While others, it's the need to just be connected as a human being.
You know, Meredith, we actually had a caller last week. I'm going to play him for you in a second. His name was Tom. He was from Norwood, who was also, like this the caller we just had, expressing a good deal of optimism that what is different can be a source of joy. Here he is.
20 years from now, we're going to remember this Thanksgiving because of how screwed up it was. And on top of that, not everybody is going enjoys Thanksgiving. You know, seeing their relatives that they might love and hate, hearing the same stories over and over again, eating the same food over and over again. This is going to be different and more memorable.
Are you hearing that, Meredith? Here, and let me put the phone number out just real quickly, 800-423-8255. We'll go back to phones in a minute. Are you hearing that from people who write into you? And are you hearing some interesting new traditions that you find kind of exciting?
Well, I actually just tweeted a literary event that's going to happen that night with a lot of writers who are single and are going to be available online, you know, reading their works. And I thought, what a cool new tradition, right, that you can log in and so I do think it's starting new traditions. And I also think I've heard a lot of people who are excited to watch a TV show they've been holding, you know, to eat something they would never eat. And I experienced this with my own family with Passover this year, that we will never forget the Passover we had on Zoom. I mean, it will be iconic forever, right? Us figuring out how to do that in March and us pulling it off. And I think there are a lot of opportunities for new memories. And I would say that also for people who are very much alone in their houses, there's also great opportunity for kindness. I mean, there are many places where you can volunteer to make phone calls on holidays to people who need those calls. It's giving people a moment to have great empathy for people who might need attention. So I would always say to somebody who's feeling lonely, you're not the only one, and there are probably ways to reach out and share that time and to give of your time. And I think that can be memorable for people too. So certainly this is not the year we wanted, but there are so many ways to make it, stay with us forever.
800-423-8255 to share what you're doing this year, how you're thinking about Thanksgiving. Maybe you're still struggling with making the decision because there's pressure in the family to be together, even though public health guidance is not to. Call, with your thoughts or your questions. We've got Michaela on the line from Topsfield. Michaela, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling. My husband and I are both veterinarians, and we typically work like the day after Thanksgiving and the weekend, and so around the holidays, the daycare is closed a lot, and so I have to rely on my parents, who are in their late 60s, for childcare. And we've decided as a family we're not having Thanksgiving, but I'm bringing my children down because the plan was for my parents to watch them the next couple days. And like, I'm pretty much still really conflicted about making this decision about whether I go down with my family or I don't work the next day. And I know that's a struggle that a lot of people have had with childcare.
So, when do you have to make the decision, Michaela?
I have to work Friday, so by Thursday.
So let's ask Omar. Omar, do you have thoughts for Michaela?
I would say the first thing to do is to prioritize what is going to be most important to you. Is it going to be the safety for your parents, in the sense of, are your parents at an age and a health, within their health, are they at risk? And then second, in terms of your career and your responsibility in terms of your job, is this something that you're able to put off, or is it a priority to maintain those relationships? Normally when I am seeing couples who are having those type of conflicts, even if it's just we're deciding to visit family during a holiday or having to do something that might interfere with other responsibilities, I would say this a five part. First is make sure that you make the decision sooner rather than later. Second is don't just stick to the facts, but more so stick to what the concerns are for either party. Because when you're just sticking to facts, it's going to be harder for people to hear that. Third is not to criticize others during that decision making, but just to ask questions to be able to understand each other's side. So, for instance, if you and your husband are for whatever reason having conflicts about whether or not to go, ask each other what are some of the conflicts or concerns around it, so that both of you are hearing each other, and as well as talking to your parents about it. The fourth is just admit that this is going to be difficult. This is one of those very unique situations where it's not just an issue around scheduling, but it's an issue around a pandemic and health crisis. And then last is to possibly think about alternatives or look for compromises within the situation. Meaning, are we going to be able to look onto our parents, or do we look onto close family and relatives, or just other alternatives that could be helpful in this situation? I'm hopeful that this is somewhat helpful to you.
So there is a list, Omar, I think that you've just given us that can guide not only part of Michaela's decision making, but a whole bunch of other people who are trying still to decide what to do on Thursday. I'm also just thinking back to a call-in we did last week with Dr. Cassandra Pierre on Thanksgiving, where she talked about, we know what the public health guidance is, but also what's important to her is harm mitigation, right? And recognizing that if people are going to take steps to be with others, then make sure you stayed isolated for the 10 to 14 days beforehand. Make sure you have a coronavirus test, or the children do, within 72 hours and it's negative before you see an older adult. So I just remember Dr. Pierre reminding us of the safety steps one can and should take if one does decide that people outside of your household are going to be with you or your family over this weekend. Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Erica on the line from Somerville. Erica, go ahead.
Christina.
Oh, I think we lost Erica. So Meredith, I'm going to come back to you. Meredith, is there advice that you found yourself repeatedly giving to people as they're struggling with this Thanksgiving set of decisions and frustrations? Yeah.
I think feeling as though you're disappointing parents is really hard, or being a parent and feeling as though not being with your kids is the right answer, and really not punishing yourself for that. But I would also say that advice I'm giving a lot right now is, we are learning in real time these questions, right? Questions about childcare, questions about testing, let's remember these lessons and think about it in terms of Christmas, because I was in Needham on Saturday and saw a testing site with a line that was wrapped around two blocks. And I thought, oh, well, now we know. Now we know that 3 days, 5 days before a holiday, everyone's going to need to get tested because they might even be driving one town over. So, you know, my thought is, if Thanksgiving isn't exactly what you want it to be, maybe you're planning for a weekend in January. Maybe you're planning for something later where you can gather with someone safely. And I also think it's a really good time for employers to look at employees and say, what can we do, right, to make this, what shifts can you take? Because, you know, we're talking about people who have the privilege to stay home in many cases, and some people don't. So I think, you know, if that's something that employers can help with as well, to think about who needs to do what, I mean, this is a much better way to sustain mental health for as long as we possibly can during this time.
All right, we got Erica back, and I do want to grab her real quick. So Erica from Somerville, go ahead.
Hi, I think that this is a great opportunity to be creative. And my family and I, we are not gathering. We are staying separate this year for safety reasons, obviously. And I'm actually turning to my local community, my group of friends, and we are doing what's called a pie tour, where we are gathering outdoors, socially distanced, and we are each baking pies to try. And I think that this is a great opportunity for us to, you know, share in that. And so I'm really excited to do that with my group of friends.
Thanks for that, Erica. So, Omar, we're almost out of time here. But before we go, let me just ask you, are there other ways, like Erica is talking about, to build community? Does this have to be a time of isolation, even if we're getting a little mic noise there, even if we can't necessarily be together with the people that we normally would, and certainly not inside? Are there other ways to build community in this moment?
Certainly. One of some of the strategies that I've heard from some of the couples that they plan on doing is, if they have family members who live close by, and especially where food is part of the tradition of this holiday, is to be able to still make the food and to be able to drop it off, of course, contactless, and then go over Zoom and then still eat shared dishes. So that way you have that shared experience. Of course, with everything going remotely, I think everybody has a full awareness of being able to try to do your best to experience those conversations or those gatherings online. Yes, it's not going to be the same, but the hope is that it will still connect everyone together.
All right. And that is Omar Ruiz, a licensed family therapist at Talk Think Thrive, and Meredith Goldstein of the Boston Globe's Love Letters advice column. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We're going to talk now about Brady lists. These are lists that prosecutors all over the country keep about police whose past conduct may disqualify them from testifying in court. Brady lists are named after a Supreme Court decision requiring prosecutors to turn over all material that could be favorable to the defense, and that includes information about past police officer conduct that might affect that officer's credibility as a witness. Spurred by the national conversation on police reform, a WBUR investigation earlier this year found only 4 out of Massachusetts' 11 district attorneys maintained Brady lists. So now in New Hampshire, there's one, it's statewide, it's called the Lori List, and it's maintained by the state attorney general's office. It has been secret, and now there's a legal battle underway to make it public. New Hampshire Public Radio senior reporter Jason Moon did a podcast about the Lori List. He joins us now. Jason, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you're well known for NHPR's Bear Brook podcast. This one also fascinating. And you start by introducing us to Nancy West, who's the reporter who kind of stumbled on the existence of this secret Lori List as a result of kind of a comedy of errors. So maybe you can start by just telling us about her and this discovery.
That's right. Nancy, she used to write for the Union Leader, the New Hampshire's largest newspaper, and she got a great tip back in the late aughts about a lawsuit between two police unions. Back in those days, there was the state troopers and the state highway patrol in New Hampshire, two different state police agencies. And they did not get along very well. And they had a whole rather petty back and forth over the years of kind of tit for tat. And eventually it reached the point of a lawsuit spurred by some fake websites that one union made to sort of impersonate the other union. But as you said, in the midst of this legal back and forth, there was lobbed the allegation that, well, one of these state troopers has a, quote, Lori issue, and so he shouldn't be able to testify. And that was kind of the first moment that Nancy West, this reporter, heard that term. And so she wanted to figure out what that meant. And discovered and was the first to publish a story about the fact that there was this Lori List, a list of police officers in New Hampshire with credibility issues, things that could be used to call into question their credibility during a criminal trial. And it was kind of an amazing discovery that this list had existed in the state for years at that point, and really no one outside the legal community knew about it.
So explain why that's a big deal. I mean, so, you know, to play devil's advocate, so it's a list. There's a list of police officers. Why is it a big deal to find out about it? And why does it matter so much?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the answer is because there's nothing else. The Lori List, in its most kind of innocuous form, it's kind of just a cheat sheet for prosecutors. They have this obligation to turn over evidence that's favorable to a defendant, and that can include information about police officers. And so it's just there for them to make sure they're not forgetting to turn over stuff to a defendant. The public interest comes in when you realize that there is no public list, public database of police officer misconduct in New Hampshire and in many states around the country. New Hampshire is a place where police officer personnel files have historically been shielded from public view. You know, as a reporter, I can't make public records requests for police officer disciplinary files, internal affairs investigations. That's all just sort of off limits. And so it really raised the stakes once people learned that there was a list of, you know, really the most complete list that exists, even though it's very incomplete and imperfect, of police officer misconduct in the state's history.
Okay, so it's called the Lori List. That's after a particular defendant, Carl Lori. And there's a case study there, essentially, with Carl Lori and a police officer named Steve Laro. And that might help underscore for listeners why this matters so much. So briefly tell us this story.
That's right. So Carl Lori was a defendant in a murder case and in the late 80s, early 90s. And his trial basically revolved around whether a confession that he gave to local police in New Hampshire was coerced, or whether the police did an improper investigation. That was kind of the defense strategy. What the defense did not know, what they learned later after Carl Laurie had been convicted of murder, was that one of the officers leading the investigation into the murder had a lengthy disciplinary record that included, you know, telling untruths and tampering with investigations. And, you know, had Carl Laurie's attorneys known of that, they could have used that in his defense. And that's ultimately what the state Supreme Court ruled. And the Laurie list was created as a way to, you know, with the aim of hopefully never having that happen again. Unfortunately, we don't really know if that's true, because the Laurie list, it's not public. No one can, you know, go behind the prosecutors and make sure that every name on the list has been turned over in every case where it should have been.
So let's talk about the public piece of this, because there's a lawsuit now, a debate, a lawsuit in New Hampshire trying to make it public. The debate about whether these lists ought to be public is not unique to New Hampshire. I'm going to play some sound for you here. Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins, she spoke to us here on Radio Boston shortly after she released her office's Brady list about this issue of transparency. Here she is.
I just think transparency is always better. There is not a single profession you can name where there is 0% bad, you know, actors. And with respect to law enforcement, in particular the police, where they have the ability to take away your life, quite frankly, and split-second decisions and your liberty with respect to arrests, we have to be beyond reproach.
So obviously she believes in that transparency, has made that list public. You talk about the lawsuit to make it public. You also tell the story of a police officer who was harmed by being on the Laurie list and for whom his career would be better if it weren't there at all, and certainly not better if it were public. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things about these lists, and particularly the Laurie list in New Hampshire, is that police officers really don't care for it either, for kind of their own set of reasons. And one of them is that being placed on the Laurie list is, I've heard it described as the kiss of death for your career as a police officer. You know, often getting placed on the Laurie list coincides with being fired. Again, we don't know how often that's the case because we don't know who's on the list. But it definitely makes it harder to get promoted, to get hired at a different police station if you're a police officer. And so we profile one officer who we know is on the Laurie list because he took a lawsuit all the way to the state Supreme Court trying to get his name off of the list. And, you know, basically the issue for this officer, John Gannert, is that the incident that put his name on the Laurie list was an incident where he put some information on a form related when he was booking a suspect that he didn't know the answer to. And he sort of made a guesstimation with some of the information he had available, and it turned out to be not true. And so he was, you know, found to have falsified a record and was put on the Laurie list because that might need to be turned over to a criminal defendant in a criminal case. You know, from his perspective, he is, you know, well, a lot of the people who got on the Laurie list are there because of much more egregious types of misconduct, you know, excessive force or, you know, deliberate lying on the witness stand. You know, if there's a spectrum of sort of police misconduct, you know, John Gannert would argue that, you know, what he did was a mistake. And he learned from it, and you know, it was an issue of training. He wasn't, you know, someone who you know, shot a suspect who was running away or something like that. And yet, he is, in a sense, sort of tarred with that same brush as being on the Laurie list, sort of unhirable, unpromotable. And so he's kept the same rank as a patrol officer in New Hampshire for about 15 years now. And so he is no fan of the list either. And you'll hear that from some other officers that, you know, they're just afraid of getting on it because once you get on it, that's kind of it. It's really, really hard to get off of the list in New Hampshire.
So having told both of those stories now, you know, the Carl Laurie story and then talking about officers who have had the experience of being on the list, we have a little time left. You did a whole podcast on this. We are talking about whether or not these lists drive accountability and whether these lists should be public, transparent to further drive accountability. Where do you come out now?
I think the takeaway for me is that all of these unintended consequences of the Brady List in New Hampshire and across the country, you know, harming police officers' careers, creating mistrust among the public, it's all just born out of that secrecy. You know, if the list was public, if we could just look at the names on the list, know why they're on there, I think it would lower the temperature, lower the stakes for this, you know, this whole story. You know, at the beginning you said it, maybe it's just a list. That might be true, but because people can't see it, I think it's natural that we would assume the worst, right? Like, why can't we know what police officers, public servants have been doing, you know, in the course of their official duties and everything else that's followed, the lawsuits, the harm to public trust, the harm to police officer careers, that all just stems from a lack of transparency.
Well, that is NHPR senior reporter Jason Moon telling us about the Lori List, focus of a new podcast there. Jason, the new podcast is called The List. Thanks so much for joining us to talk about
it. Thank you for having me.
Eight months into this pandemic, the future of Boston's hospitality industry is still uncertain. And that uncertainty is weighing heavily on people like Marta McClung. McClung is a member of Unite Here Local 26, which represents hospitality workers. She worked in housekeeping at the Omni Parker House, and she fears that the job she was laid off from in the spring might not come back. That is exactly what happened this month to 260 workers at the Marriott Copley. We talked with Marta, who lives in Somerville, earlier today as part of our series Living Through Corona, and I began by asking her how she's doing this week.
It's good, but it's for now, I worry for my future because soon the employment is done, it's finished for a lot of people, for me and for my family. It affects for pay my bills, you know, pay the mortgage, or affect for my two daughters. I have a two daughter for support. My husband is sick, and I don't know what happened after the December. I don't know.
Marta, you said that unemployment could run out for you next month. How important have unemployment payments been for you in surviving financially since you were laid off last spring?
It's affect to be very bad because if I don't have an income coming, how I pay? Maybe I go to the street because the bank, no, it's help for us, you know, it's out because I don't have the money for pay any.
This might be hard, Marta, but can you take us back to the moment last spring when you were laid off? What went through your mind at the time? And how long did you think then that you would be out of work?
I think it era coming back, you know, soon because the hotel era closed.
Yeah.
But when the hotel era open, no business.
And so you thought, Marta, that you were going to go back to work quite quickly. You didn't expect it to be 7 or 8 months.
Never, no. Yeah, I think it's not only for me, for a lot of people.
How are you feeling now about the possibility of your job coming back? Do you think eventually your job at the hotel comes back?
No, I don't think. Omni Parker House, I don't think so. My job is coming back. If you know, help for us, you know, for recall for us, maybe for 2 years or when the business go up. But for now, I don't think.
So you think it could be like 2 years?
Yes. Yeah.
What will you do?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what happened in December, after the December. I don't know. And I worry.
I can understand that. You're the breadwinner at home, and you have two daughters. Do they know how worried you are? Are you talking to them about this, or are you kind of trying to shelter them from the weight of this?
No. I talk to my daughter because this is reality life. I talk. I'm sleeping absolutely nothing and thinking how I pay the bill, how I pay the mortgage, how I buy food, because everything is expensive now.
But after the December, honestly, I don't know.
Have you found any local programs that can support or help you with things like rent, food, utilities?
No. I applied for, you know, for food stamp because this is I need it for my daughter. But this is temporary too, you know?
Are you looking for other work?
Yes, I apply, but now maybe for my age, you know, it's very difficult for find the other job.
You've spent so much of your career in hospitality. You were a part of the now famous Hyatt 100 over a decade ago. That was a group of 98 housekeepers who were fired in 2009 by the Hyatt company and then replaced with temporary workers. Yes. Do you feel like your industry has taken you for granted and doesn't respect what you've done, you know, for your hotels over the years?
Yeah, because if it is in 2009, Hyatt stay for us and put out the job, I scared the same thing, you know, the situation for the pandemic. The company maybe, you know, same thing, fire for us and hire more people, you know, deep for no benefit.
So you're both worried that the hotels will put new temporary workers in who are less expensive, essentially, to pay, and that when unemployment runs out next month, you don't know what you're going to do. So to that point, Marta, Local 26 has been pushing for a bill at the state level that would mean that laid-off hotel workers could be hired back if the job is brought back. It would give priority. Are you hopeful that that can get passed?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And do you try to work in the hotel industry in the meantime, or do you try to find a job in a different industry, given everything you've experienced?
I try, yeah. I like hotel, you know. I like working in a hotel because this is my experience. But if you have other opportunities, looking, you know, for different job, because now the hotel, the business has gone down.
And what do you need most from your community right now, Marta? What do you need most from other people?
Our community and the other people, you know, push from our hotel, you know, to give them the working back and the community, you know, everybody together, because the community sometimes help for us, you know, maybe looking for other job or maybe support for donation. I don't know. But that's why I wanted my job back.
So push for hotel workers to get their jobs back.
Yeah.
And Marta, how are you going to observe Thanksgiving? What do you do for Thanksgiving this week?
The Thanksgiving this week, I don't plan absolutely nothing because I need to buy food this week because I don't have nothing. And I don't celebrate because I stay here in the house. This is my plan, buy something and stay in the house because I can't spend money, you know?
That's Marta McClung. She's a housekeeper for Omni Parker House. Marta, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. Our engineer today is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer, Hitesh Hathi. And I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.